This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
Yesterday, the Astros were sad. Today, the baseball world is mad. No, it's not a terrible Valentine's Day rhyme that's starting. It is Danny and Gallant, and no, we're not going to start on more sign stealing. No trash can banging. Instead, we're going to beat the dead horse that is the concern over the Seahawks offensive line.
Ooh, that, what a twist. We're going to the thing that you consider to be more of a quarterback problem at times, the protection for one Russell Wilson.
I thought you were going to say the thing that I consider to be the most redundant, nauseating conversation that comes up every single year right about this time.
Yeah.
In fact, to the point where I don't want to talk about
but
it.
But I just have a little bit more of a positive spin on it because, Danny, I'm new here, and I want you to know that the offensive line could be a little better. Don't you agree? You have to.
It could be. It could also be worse. And I'm convinced that no matter what they do, we're going to have the exact same conversation 12 months from now. This is the Groundhog's Day of Seattle Seahawks football. It is the offensive line. And when are they going to do something to get Russell some protection? And, well, they do have a bit of a different question right now because they've got – is their offensive line good? Like, that's debatable. Whether it's expensive – that's fairly certain, and it's about to get more expensive. And you've got two players in particular, Justin Britt, who is under contract and going to cost more than $10 million next season as it currently is budgeted. And then you've got Jermaine Ifedi, who's about to become expensive because he's going to be a free agent. Do you keep Britt, let Ifedi walk? Do you cut Britt and bring Ifedi back, or do you let both go?
See, that last part is what's really interesting. You could see potentially four of the Seahawks starting offensive linemen gone this offseason, and you're only left with Dwayne Brown, who's getting closer and closer to 35 years old, because also you have Mike Iupati, who you have to consider, and DJ Fluker, who you have to consider the futures of. If you want me to answer that question specifically, Danny, I think you let Ifedi walk, but I don't think you can let Justin Britt go. And it's unfortunate because I think a lot of people were looking at him in past weeks as someone who would be a really easy cap casualty to free
save
up some cap space. Right. I mean, you're saving $10+ million if you were to move on from Justin Britt. But I don't think you can when you think about all the guys that could be leaving this offseason. Continuity on the offensive line is extremely important. You want to have some sort of established rapport, especially now that offseasons have changed so much in the NFL where guys aren't able to practice as much with one another as they were in years past. If they were to move on from 60% of their offensive line this offseason, there will be a feeling out process. And sometimes when there's a feeling out process, that means a lot of sacks. Worse, it could mean the one thing that the Seahawks have been good at on the offensive line, which is paving the way for Chris Carson and Rashad Penny and all those running backs to run for as many yards as they did this past season, then you're going to find yourself in a really tricky situation.
Here's Ray Roberts, who was on with Bob, Dave, and Moore earlier this week, talking about the importance of continuity along the offensive line.
No, that's a real thing. I've heard people I've heard people before say like they kind of discount the chemistry and stuff along the offensive line, and if you've been in an offensive line room or you've played offensive line, like that is even, let's say I'm the left tackle and the left guard is a dude that's struggling, but he's a guy that's a starter or whatever. The fact that I kind of know where he struggles, I kind of understand, you know, what he's bringing to the table. It even if it's something that's not the greatest, even just knowing that and how to work with that is needed in the offensive line room. So you can't just throw dudes in and pull them out and at different times and think like, oh, we're just going to plug this guy in and just keep it going.
I totally understand that, Paul. Here would be my counterpoint to that, is that if you're afraid of making changes, you're essentially saying we're going to put more money into something that wasn't a strength last year. I don't think anybody looks at the offensive line and says, hey, that's one of the things that you need to preserve. And in a year when you're talking about accentuating this team's strengths, is it throwing good money after bad if you start paying more to a position that didn't distinguish itself in the beginning?
That's a good question. I think the problem is that you're in a situation where you're not fixing this quickly. Like, if you were to bring these guys back, you're overpaying, yeah. But if you move on from them, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to sign some other guys in free agency and you'll probably have to overpay for them? Are you drafting some players? Good luck getting contributions from them right away. It's really difficult to get offensive linemen to know what the heck they're doing right out of college. So that's a really dicey situation that the Seahawks have themselves in right now with the offensive line. And, you know, you would think that drafting a guy like Jermaine Urfedy in the first round would have answered a lot of problems, but we're at the point right now where, what are the Seahawks now, 0-2 in the last decade when it comes to taking a high investment in an offensive lineman?
They've done it twice, and neither time have they picked up the fifth-year option on the guy, which is essentially saying, hey, we think we hit a solid double here. We think we've got a guy that we want to keep around. Both with James Carpenter, who was drafted in 2011, and with Jermaine Urfedy, neither one of them had that fifth-year option picked up by the team, which is why Urfedy is about to become an unrestricted free agent. Here is Ray Roberts talking about Urfedy specifically.
Well, I've always been a fan of Jermaine Urfedy's, and you know, I thought that from the very beginning, them playing him at guard was a mistake. If you drafted a dude to play tackle, then you need to put him at tackle. The space is different. The speed at which things happen is different. The muscle memory is different. Like, there's a ton of differences between playing guard and then playing tackle. So to play guard for a year and then all of a sudden be thrown back out to tackle, it just kind of throws you off a little bit. And sometimes I think that that people think of offensive linemen as like interchangeable parts, and you can play the left side or the right side or what have you, and it's just big dudes running into big dudes. But it might be like the most misunderstood position in all of sports, because it's more than that.
Now, the one thing is, we fixed the switching guys position because we fired Tom Cable. He's out of here. We're not moving guys around like chess pieces anymore. They're being drafted, and they're playing in a spot, and they're filling that. Maybe it's helpful, Paul, here to back up and to say the guys that we're most concerned. I think the toughest decision for this team is Justin Britt. I think the second toughest decision is going to be George Fant. I actually don't have that much desire to bring Jermaine Urfedy back, simply because I think he's going to get to the open market and he's going to cost an awful lot of money. And if you weren't willing to pay a one-year contract at the fifth-year option, I don't think you're going to be willing to go the 4 or 5 years that right. He's going to get. I'm not worried about Upati because I actually like Jamarco Jones. And then lurking around in the back is, if you bring Upati and or Fluker back, have them compete with Phil Haynes for the other guard spot, I think that's okay. I think the tough decision for this team is Justin Britt, who has been a leader, who is expensive, and as much as you might want to try to talk to him about renegotiating his deal to bring that cap number down, if I'm Justin Britt, I'm going to be looking out there at that free agent market and saying, guys are going to get paid. And if you're going to ask me to take a pay cut, I'm going to go out there and see what other people are willing to pay me.
If I'm Justin Britt, I'm going to bring a laptop into the negotiation table. I'm going to set it on the table, and I'm going to have three clips of Joey Hunt being thrown into oblivion, just back to back to back. And I'm just going to close the laptop after it, put my hands on the table, and just look into John Schneider's eyes. That's all I'll do.
That's not fair. That's not fair. We like Joey Hunt.
We do like Joey Hunt.
Don't you be mean to little Joey Hunt.
We do like Joey Hunt. I'm not trying to be mean to Joey Hunt, but the reality is Justin Britt's better.
You're saying that you'd use the video footage of him getting ragdolled as a negotiating point. That's incredibly mean.
It's the no fun league. It is a cutthroat league. I'm trying to keep my job. I'm trying to keep my contract. And I think at this point, I don't think you can move on from Justin Britt just given this current situation. I think you can slide Jamarco Jones into one of those guard spots. Which one? I suppose the Seahawks have to figure that out. I don't know if Phil Haynes is ready, but you might be in a situation where he has to be ready. George Fant wants to be a starting tackle. Do you feel confident in him being a starting tackle? Those are the questions you have to answer yourself. And ultimately, if you move on from Urfedy, Danny, here is probably a reality. With Duane Brown's age, what is he, 33, 34 years old right mm-hmm. now, and with no right tackle, you're probably going to have to invest one of your first three picks in that offensive tackle position, because you need to have somebody at the very least for the future, for after Duane Brown, for life after him. And on top of that, I mean, it probably would make sense to try to draft the guy to develop him at the very least into becoming a swing tackle, if not the actual starting right tackle.
I'm puzzled about Fant. I expected him to compete with Urfedy last year at right tackle. He didn't even get a sniff at that. In training camp, they had him. He was their third tackle from beginning to end. I think he's a really good backup left tackle. I don't know what his ceiling is. Could he be in 3 years the replacement for Duane Brown? Is that a guy that you get here? I really like George Fant. I worry that my own personal preference for him, I love how tough he is. I love the fact that he's made the transition from basketball. I love the way that he came back from a knee injury. Sort of clouds my belief that, okay, he's got a bigger upside. In my mind, I would prefer Fant back over Justin Britt and over Jermaine Ifedi.
Okay, so you want Fant back. Okay, and you know what? I'd like to see Fant get an opportunity out at tackle. We saw a little bit of it this past season, and honestly, he did hold his own in those spots.
I thought he looked good.
It wasn't like where Jamarco Jones, when he got slid out to tackle, and Ray talked about moving guys from position to position. That was really because of injuries and all that. But Jamarco Jones against Chandler Jones, it did not go so well.
That was not fair.
Right. But George Fant, I mean, I'd like to see him get an opportunity at tackle. And I guess the question is, can you somehow get a discount from George Fant saying, hey, look, like, we're going to make you the starter, and you have to basically prove that you can be that guy, but we're not going to pay you starter money. We've held you in the system. You know the system. Now it's time for you to prove your worth. And I don't know if he's going to be up for that. He might be someone who's like, you know what? I think I put enough tape out there that someone's going to give me a starting gig somewhere else, which means I actually get paid.
It's Danny and Gallant. It's time to get to What to Watch For.
What to Watch For, every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dubin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
Gregory Olsen wrapped up his tour with the Seattle Seahawks. He visited with them on Wednesday, and he is choosing between the Bills, the epithets, did I pronounce that right, the Seahawks and the Foxes or the CBSs? Is it Fox singular?
Fox.
I don't know.
Let's do an NFC.
I think the most serious competition, Danny, to the Seahawks is a television network. It's not Buffalo. It's not the Washington teams. How do you feel about that?
I think it is the TV network as well. I think that is the spot that is going to be toughest for him. He's got to choose whether he wants to put his body through the grinder again, whether he's able to do that, or whether he wants, look, at this point, his salary as a broadcaster is probably going to get pretty darn close. I'm hoping that he wants one more bite at the apple, that he wants one more ride, and that he looks at what Jason Witten did and said, that will always be there for me. I don't want to leave good football on the table. I'm hoping we hear later this morning that Greg Olsen's going to be a Seahawk.
I do as well, and just like I would bring up a laptop if I were Justin Britt to stake my case for why I need to keep the center job. If I'm the Seahawks, I am presenting all of Will Disley's highlights with Russell Wilson because Russ clearly likes tight ends. Jacob Hollister, what he was able to do as well.
I would have a question.
Yeah.
If a defensive lineman, say Fletcher Cox, picks up Joey Hunt like forklifts him, feet off the ground, and throws him, turns him into a lawn dart type throwing implement, and throws him into Russell Wilson and knocks Russ down, does that count as a sack?
It should.
Or because it's Russell's teammate and he fell down, that it's not, he hasn't come into contact with an opponent, so can Russell get up and run?
Well, that's a fair point. I don't know the actual rules on that. I think if Fletcher Cox does that, it should count as a forward pass. So he gets a completed pass. Two. One for one.
We're terrible. I'm even meaner than you are. That's awful.
What to watch for.
Washington loses again. There are two certainties in Seattle sports life. If the Seattle Seahawks draft a wide receiver in the fourth round, he's going to stink. And the second one is that if Washington gets one-and-done caliber talent, a guy that can go to the NBA, they're not making the tournament. They've got two of those dudes. They were up 42-41 against USC, whom they've beaten four straight times. They didn't score a point for 6 minutes and 47 seconds. They went 8 minutes and 29 seconds without a field goal, and they lose 62-56. They're terrible.
To make matters worse, I mean, USC was without their leading scorer and leading rebounder. So
it doesn't matter. Who cares? Washington can't score down the stretch. This team has no finishers. This team gets no coffee. This team doesn't even get hot chocolate. They can't close.
Will there be any consequences?
Well, what are the consequences can be? Like Hopkins? No,
yeah.
We love Hopkins.
Okay.
No, I'm just asking.
Hopkins
made the NCAA tournament last year, was the Pac-12 coach of the year in each of his first two seasons.
He's also a Syracuse graduate, so he's smarter than everyone, so that's important too. Yeah.
Well, what's his SAT score? Have you talked
math,
to him about
math, specifically?
That?
Math?
Definitely over 700.
What to watch for.
All right, so... sorry, I lost my spot on the rundown. Mitch Haniger, unfortunately, has had yet another surgery. So we talked about the surgery for a hernia. Now we're talking about a surgery for his back. Yikes.
Do you want to hear Jerry DePoto explain it?
Yes, please.
Mitch had a procedure called a microdiscectomy, which is a little bit different. And I guess there are two potential, I guess, descriptions of a discectomy and a discectomy. This is the microdiscectomy. And I'm not a doctor, but it was just a small repair of a vertebrae. And we don't have a timeline for his return. He's in the hospital, recovering right now. We believe the procedure went well. Seems to be in pretty good spirits, I think, as you probably saw. And you know, we're expecting that he will be here in camp, though we don't have a timeline for that either.
Don't have a timeline, and it's back surgery. And I've seen that he said that he doesn't think it will be all of 2020. Yeah, that sounds like we're probably not going to see him before August playing baseball. That would be my guess.
Doesn't DePoto just sound so tired, too?
Oh, yeah, he did. I hate, because it might be early and maybe he had to stay up late, but yeah, that was the audio sounded like a guy who had just found out that one of his best players, and maybe his best position player, is sort of had the double whammy of surgeries that he's having. That is what to watch for. We'll also have some NFL news that we'll ask the professor about right now. John Clayton joining us for the Morning Drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, what's the latest on Greg Olsen?
Just waiting, negotiating with three teams, and I guess that the idea would be trying to get something done today. So the wait is on.
Now, is it four teams because we have to throw Fox's broadcast group in there? So it's Washington, Buffalo, Seattle, and Fox?
No, I don't think so, because I don't know if the TV contract that he might have would be equal to what he's going to get here in the NFL, because you figure it's going to be at least $5.2 to $5.3 million on this deal for the NFL, and I don't know if it's going to be able to match that in the broadcast booth.
We talk about Greg Olsen, former Panther. Another former Panther is now a former Redskin. We're talking about Josh Norman, who was released by Washington today. John, do you think there's any chance that the Seahawks make a phone call about him?
Maybe, yeah, because, again, he's available. It's not going to cost a compensatory pick. I mean, he's a talented cornerback. You know, the cost may be a little bit too much, but, again, we'll have to see. But it's kind of like the Greg Olsen thing. It's like, okay, here's a guy that you can get in hand early. And, you know, I don't know what the drop-off in his career was in Washington, but it got to the point where they weren't hardly playing him last year. So I don't know if it's one of those things where he's lost his speed, whatever it is. But I'd have to think it's going to be worth a phone call.
John, Myles Garrett was reinstated, and we now have sound and have heard that he told Mina Kimes in an Outside the Lines interview. We had heard after the incident that Myles Garrett had told NFL investigators that Mason Rudolph used a racial slur. He's now Garrett has said that on film and said and made that allegation public. He's obviously served his punishment. He says that he knows what he's heard, but the NFL's already investigated this and said they found no evidence of it, mm-hmm. Correct?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, so it's one where, you know, I think, you know, he's speaking a little bit out of turn, because if there's no proof that you can do it, or the NFL doesn't have anything, then there's nothing that can happen. And it's like, hey, listen, Miles, just be happy that you've been reinstated. You know, why pull down the career, at least of Mason Rudolph, if you don't have the proof to be able to do it? You know, they have audio. They have all those different things that they can do. They listen to the audio. They fined him $50,000 for at least trying to swing back and getting back in that stuff. It's like, hey, Miles, it's like, just be quiet. I mean, you were able to come back and get, you know, the lesser of the suspension. You're back in the league right now, but why go ahead and do this? Mistake on his part.
If they had the information, though, John, do you think the NFL would actually release it?
Yes. I think so, yeah, because if they have the evidence to do it, then, you know, you have no choice, particularly with the Players Association, but to, you know, put that against Mason Rudolph and try to go ahead and, you know, add to what was his fine or what you're going to do with Mason Rudolph, because, you know, there's rules against those type of words being used on the field. I mean, if an official does it, which, of course, I think has been there was an allegation of that happened one time, then there's going to be ramifications. But, no, I think that if they could have had the evidence, if they would have been able to hear something like that, they would have done something.
Here's why I wonder, John, though, because Mason Rudolph appealed his $50,000 fine that he got for basically getting conked on the head with a helmet. And, I mean, he may have instigated the situation, but he still got fined $50,000, and the NFL did not overturn that $50,000 fine. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if there's something else that maybe they just don't want us to know about, and I wouldn't blame them entirely for trying to keep all of this secret.
No, I don't think that was the case. I mean, they fined him $50,000 for at least getting this thing going and getting the battle started and all that stuff. I mean, no, I think that if there was proof there, they would have at least gone to it and admitted it and said it.
Josh Norman doesn't fit in Seattle, does he? Because I look at him and I was like, man, I don't see that being a fit. But maybe you could see him as a slot corner. Is there any potential crossover there?
Not as a slot corner. I think he'd be more of an outside corner. He'd be somebody to challenge Trey Flowers and all that. Because again, I think Ugo Amadi is going to be the slot cornerback. I think they like what they see of him and they like the youth. I mean, you know, Norman still isn't overly too old, but no, I think if they sign him and it has to be for pretty lower price. I mean, he's not going to be making the $15 million, $14 million that he's making now before he was released. So it's like, no, I think that he would be more of an outside guy than anything on the slot.
Of the three offensive linemen, Justin Britt, Jermaine Ifedi, George Fant, two of those guys are free agents. Justin Britt has a big cap number. How many of those guys do you think are back with the Seahawks next year?
I mean, it could be two. Depends on what Fant's numbers are going to be. And, you know, Fant's really insistent about playing left tackle. Because, you know, right now Dwayne Brown's the left tackle. The Britt situation doesn't have to happen anytime soon. You know, it's like if they're going to do anything, wait till training camp. Wait to see. Because now if you let him go and you cut him for cap reasons, I mean, now you're making too many changes on the offensive line. Clearly you want to have Justin Britt back. I mean, he's your starting center. But it's like, don't worry about the cap. You've got $60 million of cap. If you need to make an adjustment in his contract, do it in August.
Brandon Cook said that Jared Goff is absolutely the guy, and I think it's interesting just to hear all this conversations about the two other quarterbacks in the NFC West that have big contracts but a lot of questions between them, Jimmy Garoppolo and Jared Goff. John, who is more the guy? Is it Jared Goff or is it Jimmy Garoppolo?
I'd say probably Jimmy Garoppolo. But remember, I mean, say what you want about him. Both quarterbacks have been he's taken their teams to the Super Bowl.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, it's certainly better than, I'm not saying that these two quarterbacks are better than Matthew Stafford. Are they better than Kirk Cousins? But they've taken their teams to the Super Bowl. So it's like, we can talk about, how they're not great. They're not elite quarterbacks, but they're good enough to get their teams to the Super Bowl. And so that makes them a guy.
Tyrod Taylor, are you buying him as starting quarterback for your Los Angeles Chargers?
I'm starting to if they do take Justin Herbert with a sixth pick in the draft. I mean, if they're they're in a position where they can get one of the top three quarterbacks in the draft. And if that's what their plan is, I mean, okay, fine. You go Tyrod Taylor. You admit that you're not going to be a winning team or you're going to be, 7-9, 8-8 type of team. I can see that happening. I think so, still, if you're moving into a new stadium and you're not selling tickets, which they're not being able to sell tickets, reach out for one of the other quarterbacks. But I think that could be the plan right now for the Chargers.
Oh, Professor, don't let him pick an Oregon quarterback. I kind of like the Chargers. Don't let him make that bust. That guy has bust written all over him. Jeff Herbert, big, big bust.
Well, we'll see.
Professor's not buying my anti-duck antagonism.
No.
You mentioned selling tickets just a moment ago, John, and I wonder about Tim Tebow. Tim Tebow is still playing baseball. He says he wants to be remembered for being someone who goes after what he believes in.
Well, I thought we were talking about NFL quarterbacks.
There we go. That's what you just made the first of two classic blunders, the first of which is never fight a land war in Asia. Second and only slightly less lethal, never try to discuss Tim Tebow with the professor when we're talking about the NFL.
No, we're talking NFL quarterbacks, so we can't talk Tim Tebow.
Shouldn't they bring him back?
For what?
He could be Taysom Hill, like old man version.
He stinks. He can't play quarterback in the NFL.
Oh, Professor. Paul doesn't know. Paul's a newbie.
I didn't know.
He was just introduced. Yes, that's correct. Professor loves Tim Tebow. He thinks he's a great guy. He thinks he's an absolutely terrible quarterback. In fact, you probably shouldn't even use that word to describe him because it's not the position he plays.
One of the worst quarterbacks in the NFL I've ever seen.
Wow. He's not much better at baseball.
Well, at least he's a baseball player. He wasn't a quarterback. I know that. In the
Professor,
NFL.
Professor, we love you, man. We look forward to talking to you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
I'll talk to you on Tuesday, right?
Correct.
That's true.
President's Day. We're going to be off, so we'll talk to you on Tuesday.
Okay.
That is the Professor John Clayton. You can hear him 10 to noon, the John Clayton Show, also in the afternoon with Bob, Dave, and more. Coming up next, Taiwan Walker. He's your newest Mariner, but he's also an older Mariner. We're going to welcome him back to Seattle. That's next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It is Danny and Gallant. We're joined now on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline by, he's a new Mariner, but he's actually someone we're very familiar with. So this feels more like instead of welcoming him to Seattle, we're welcoming him back to Seattle. Taiwan Walker's with us. Taiwan, what's going on, man?
Hey, what's going on? Nothing much.
I would like to say congratulations. I'm really excited to see you back with Seattle. I think it's a great opportunity for you. Why don't you start out by telling us kind of how this came together?
So it was kind of a weird process for me this offseason, being non-tendered and I guess kind of being a free agent and going through it. And it was really just kind of, we wanted to make sure we were going to a spot that was going to have my best interest. And from the very beginning, Seattle was in it the whole way. And they, you know, talking with Jerry and them, and, you know, we really realized, and when I found out that KT was the head trainer here because I was with him with Arizona, it just made too much sense for me to come here. So
mentally, where are you right now? Over the last 2 years, just 14 innings pitched, and now you're coming back to a place where you've pitched before.
You know, mentally, I'm good. I'm good. You know, it was two long years through the one inning at the end of the year, and that really helped me for my peace of mind going into the offseason, knowing that I was able to throw that one inning and walk off and walk off healthy. And just going into the offseason, having a normal offseason again, and not have to worry about rehab and stuff, just worry about getting ready for a 2020 season. So coming into camp, you know, I feel really good, I feel strong, and I feel confident where I'm at.
People in Seattle obviously are very familiar with your development, watching and following you through the minor leagues, and there was a lot of thought when you were traded to Arizona that, man, that's a trade that we'll end up regretting. And for you, it showed, I thought, that health is kind of the biggest variable in baseball. I was interested, what have you learned about yourself in the comeback, having Tommy John surgery and coming back from that? What have you learned about yourself?
You know, I feel like you see a lot of guys who have Tommy John, and, you know, it goes one or two ways. You know, you put the work in, and, you know, you go every single day, and you just, you know, just really focus on your rehab every single day, and you can come back better. And or, you know, you get lazy and don't put the work in, and, you know, you just have issues. And I feel like going through this process, it gave me a chance to sit back and, you know, realize the work that I needed to put in my rehab to be able to come back and come back better. Obviously, I had a little setback. But it was one of those things where it sucked and I was bummed about it, but I wasn't mad because I knew that I put the work in that I needed to, and I went above and beyond with the work that I needed to put in. It was just an unfortunate thing that happened. So,
the rehab's in the rearview mirror. Is it difficult to trust that nothing bad is going to happen again the next time you throw a ball, given what's happened the last 2 years?
I mean, yeah. I would say, yeah, I mean, it's definitely in the back of my mind, and it's just one of those things now where I go through spring and I just continue to get stronger and build up that eventually when I'm out there and I'm throwing, I won't have that in the back of my mind. Obviously, you know, being out for 2 years, and it's tough, you know, it's really tough mentally, but I know that I'm healthy, I know that I feel good, and I know that eventually I'll get over that hump and everything will be good.
We're talking to Taiwan Walker here, and it's interesting. We spend a lot of time talking about the Seahawks, and I know you're a football fan and love the NFL as well. The Seahawks have actually not shied away from picking guys with who have undergone serious injuries, and one of the reasons is because they think they learn more about the player and his ability to come back from adversity, and that the reality is being a professional athlete and being a pitcher, you're probably going to get hurt at some point, and your ability to come back is kind of what's going to determine the success of your career.
100%, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, you know, you get to focus on yourself and step away from the sport when you go through a serious injury, and I think that definitely does something for you mentally. You know, it just kind of makes you stronger.
Are you different as a pitcher now?
I would say so. I mean, obviously, I know, you know, watching, I got a chance to watch a lot of different pitchers over the last couple of years, and just kind of watch how they all went about the business, you know, watching Scherzer and all these guys who go out there and they dominate every start and kind of figuring out why. But, you know, I realized that they all have the same thing in common, you know. They all just go out there and, you know, they really give it their all. And, you know, mentally they just attack hitters. And so just learning that, watching that, I feel like mentally when I go into a pitching now, like, I'm going to take that same mentality.
You said when you were last with the Mariners that you weren't as mature as you are now. What's the biggest thing that you learned while playing for the Diamondbacks, especially being on that 93-win team in 2017?
Just going about my business differently. You know, having some really good veterans, guys who've won World Series and, you know, who've won and has been on, you know, losing teams and stuff, like just learning from them and learning how they went about their business every single day and what they brought to the game, and just kind of took a little small stuff from each one of them. They were really big and just, you know, helping me become a better pitcher, especially in 17. I feel like it was one of my best years. But, you know, everyone was just so hungry to go out there and work and to get after it. So it was good to be around them.
I know you like the NFL. Are you a college football fan? Did you enjoy LSU's success this year? You're from Louisiana.
Yeah, I did. You know, I like college football. I don't really watch it a whole lot. I remember when I was watching it, I was when Reggie Bush was at USC. I kind of just slowed down watching it, but it was good to see LSU win it this year.
I've looked through your Twitter handle, and you seem to be quite the rabid Saints fan. Were you one of those people that was, like, protesting after the pass interference with the Rams a couple years ago?
It was so bad. I was so mad. And it took me everything not to say tweet something. It was rough. It was definitely rough. But, you know, even this year, man, I was like, oh. I really thought this year was our year, too. So
yeah, losing to Kirk Cousins does not make things easier, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was rough.
Almost everybody's changed over in that clubhouse, and I'm kind of going in my mind trying to think of which. Is Seager the only guy in that clubhouse that you've played with before?
Seager and Vogelbach.
Oh, Vogie, that's right. Yeah, you were there with Vogie. Vogie, how's Vogie look so far this spring?
He's not here yet. I haven't seen him yet, so I'm sure he'll be here soon. And I think Elliot and Goody's here, obviously, but he's on the other side now coaching, so.
What's your experience been as now a father, as a pitcher at the same time? How do you balance the two of those things?
You know, I feel like I've always done a good job of this. Is, you know, when I'm at work, you know, when I'm pitching, good or bad, I don't take it home with me, you know, because I feel like it's a separate life, and I don't want to have a bad game and go home and, you know, be pouting about it and, you know, take it home and, you know, just focus so much on my bad outing that I don't spend time with my son or my wife or my family. So I feel like I've always done a pretty good job of that. So I definitely keep those two separate, you know, good or bad game. I just, you know, celebrate, do whatever at the field and go home and I just enjoy my family.
Taiwan, again, welcome back to Seattle. We're really excited. We're actually going to be down there at spring training here a little more than a week from now. We look forward to saying hi to you. And seriously, perfect. I think this is going to be a great season for you, and I'm really excited to see you back with the Mariners.
Welcome
Congratulations.
Back,
yeah, thank you, man. I really appreciate that, guys. Thank you.
All right, that is Taiwan Walker from the Seattle Mariners returning here. Signed with the team earlier this week. He'll be competing for one of the spots in the rotation. One of the guys who was at one point one of the big three in the Mariners farm system as he came up through that development path and now back with the team. Coming up next, 24 hours ago, I was pretty sure, Paul, that Jim Crane was the dumbest Major League Baseball owner. Now I think he's the smartest.
Are you Astros PR now?
The case for Jim Crane as evil genius, that's coming up next on Danny and Gallant.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Paul, I've reached a conclusion.
Okay.
Jim Crane is either the dumbest owner in Major League Baseball or he's the smartest, and there is no middle ground. It's one or the other.
I mean, based off of yesterday, I think dumb is a very safe conclusion to come to, just given how many times he used his own words against himself.
Now, what if, though, what if, and is going to, you're going to have to follow me here for just a second. What if he just wants you to think that he's dumb? What if he just wants you to think that he is so stupid
that he can...
Yeah, well, I'll explain it here in a second. Okay. What if this was part of an act in which he decided, I'm going to go out there and perform as the densest billionaire you've ever seen? That's going to be my role today, and I'm going to say things like this.
Listen, the Yankees have had a few comments out there. You know, our opinion is, you know, that this didn't impact the game. We had a good team. We won the World Series, and we'll leave it at that.
We'll leave it at that. He's then went back 55 seconds later, was saying, I never said it didn't impact the game, which he had said it. And here was the coup de grace, the final twist, the final nail in the coffin.
So how is it that it doesn't affect competition? So then what are you guys apologizing for?
We're apologizing because we broke the rules.
But isn't sign stealing a distinct advantage for the hitter? So doesn't it automatically impact competition?
It could possibly do that. It could possibly not.
Okay, guys, we're going to wrap up. Thank you, Dusty. Thank you, Jim.
It defies belief that a guy that rich, who you can't accident, can you accidentally become a billionaire like that? I mean, you have to have some level of just general competence, right?
In his defense, how often is a owner being placed in press conference situations? And as someone who has sat with him in a room and done an hour-long interview with him, I just think he's someone that does not know how to improvise. I think that he has a set plan as to how he goes and attacks things, and he does not plan on the variables. And I think often some of these guys who have all this money are a little bit out of touch and always think themselves to be the smartest person in the room, when in reality, we're all pretty much on the same level of intelligence and a lot of different things.
Wait, we all don't have 700 scores on the math portion of the SATs.
Oh, yeah, 720 on the English. Yeah.
Now, I would like to, let me present an alternative interpretation. On the one side is a billionaire who's bad with people, can't improvise, and the Socratic wisdom of the sporting press was able to reduce him to a blithering
Socrates. Wow. Pulling
yes.
that out.
So that's one element of it. What if, though, you looked at it as that he went in there with the idea and the question of, how can I attract all of the vitriol and the hatred? Which, by the way, I'm probably going to get, even if I give the most sterling performance. How can I keep that? How can I best distract and prevent people from focusing that upon my players, who I'm actually hoping are going to be able to prepare for the season? What if his goal in going in there was, I am going to become the target of everyone? We can't control how many people are going to be looking at this. In fact, no matter what we do, even if we said we're not going to talk about it at all, the entire sporting press is going to have its attention fixated on us. The Super Bowl's done. Yeah, the XFL's going on, and the NBA All-Star Game's happening, but everybody's going to be looking at us. And what if I make myself the village idiot that kind of runs through and everybody comes away? Because if you look at it another way, the net result of this is that Jim Crane owned a team that systematically cheated during the season in which it won the franchise's first World Series. I mean, caught red-handed, baseball bats going against the trash can. You could go back and count the number of times they cheated. They are caught dead to rights. And for that, here's what they got. The punishment was he had to fire a middle manager in A.J. Hinch, right?
Yep.
I mean, A.J. Hinch is pretty much the definition of middle management. He had to fire a GM who is very smart, but had already shown himself to be a liability when it comes to dealing with people. Like, this isn't the first time we've looked at it and like, this guy might have some issues when it comes to being a CEO because it doesn't look like he's much of a people person. Those are the two punishments. Doesn't have to vacate any wins. Doesn't have to give back any World Series rings. And now, after he spends 25 minutes looking like a rube in front of the God and everybody and all these TV cameras, and the storyline coming out of it isn't about whether or not Bregman cheated or whether Jose Altuve is really as lovable as he seems. it's even, I mean, a little bit, people don't really like Verlander because he was holier than thou before. And nobody, we don't like anything in this country more than we like yanking a person off of their high horse. But for the most part, all of the anger is like, can you believe this idiot? And he might be sitting there opening up a single malt scotch and saying to himself, well, looks like I pulled the wool over their eyes. They hate me, but I don't even have to see them because I'm a billionaire. Meanwhile, my team's going to go out and maybe win another World Series.
You know, I think, though, that he could have been more distracting away from his players by having gone more Vince McMahon, and he didn't do that. I think ultimately people were going to focus on what he said the most more than anyone because he is the person that pulled the plug on both Hinch and on Jeff Luhnow. But honestly, I think you're giving him too much credit here, Danny. I think that this would be quite the ploy, but I think that we would have seen and noticed some things that would have been almost antagonistic from Crane if that's what he was trying to do.
When I first said this and thought this yesterday during the show, I was like, there's a 20% chance this is true. I now think it's like 65% or
65.
70%. I actually think it's more likely that this was the desired result than that he was a blithering idiot.
Give him that much credit. That's not our narrative.
No, I know. But that's the thing is, for the most part, and I believe that no one has ever gone broke underestimating the stupidity of the American public. Like, I think in general, like, you can absolutely expect people to be as stupid as they appear. In this case, though, he's so stupid that it defies believability for me. I think he's a genius.
He's stupid because he did this, and he agreed to do it, and he thought that it was going to go in a controlled manner. That's what he thought was going to happen. That's why they held this press conference.
Is the net result bad for him, though? Is the net result bad for him?
No, the fan base is rallying around him. The fan base was going to rally around him regardless, though. It did not matter what he said. He could have actually said no words and just been a stuttering Stanley up there and just vomit all over himself even more than he actually did. And people still would probably in Houston be rallying around him and saying, yeah, we're the outlaw team. Woohoo!
Does it matter if they rally around the owner at all, though? Really?
No.
As long as they rally behind the players?
Right, it's all about
because
the players.
Because he took all of the attention off the players yesterday.
Yes.
Because of that.
It.
I know, it's annoying, Danny. You might be right.
But nationally, nobody hates Bregman right now. Nobody hates Bregman. They all hate Jim Crane and think he's an idiot.
Here's the drawback, though. I think of all the guys who apologized, it wasn't Verlander. Verlander's apology was not very good. Lydia laid that out in the Blitz pretty well. And also, there were some other guys, too. I think it was Josh Reddick wasn't a very good apology either. I mean, Altuve
didn't
resonate.
Even say that he should apologize.
He strikes me as a thinker.
But if... I think that Jim Crane, what he did, it overshadowed the one actually good apology. Carlos Correa's apology was actually like a very good, thought out, I thought, sounding authentic kind of apology. And now everyone's talking about Jim Crane, and we have actual apology analysts, which apparently is a thing, that are writing think pieces on this.
You've been working with me for now how long?
Yes.
Of course, I am an apology analyst.
But we're
I'm an expert
radio.
At it.
We're different.
How dare you?
Oh, you're
how
an official.
Dare you diminish my magnitude,
I'm
my
sorry
expertise.
I took away from your titles. My bad, dude.
It's Danny and Gallant. We're going to bring in Michael Bumpus. He's going to join us next. We got some sound from Myles Garrett that might explain what happened in that Thursday night game. That's ahead.